And it's expectant hush.
It's probably a sign that we need to get started. Thanks so much, everybody, for coming. It's excellent to see you at this meeting this evening, which has been called by Media Workers Against the War. Since we called the meeting, events have moved quite quickly, really. And one of the ideas behind calling this meeting has been because Media Workers Against the War, we feel that media workers ought to be in a position to be able to respond quickly to events, in particular events in the media. My name is David Crouch. I'm the chair of Media Workers Against the War. I work as a news editor on the Financial Times website. Before that, I worked for several years in magazines in EMAP and CMP and other places. And we have tonight for you a panel of some of the most well-informed, outspoken, and committed commentators on and in the media in this country, and I'm very glad to welcome them. But this meeting is very much not just about listening to great speakers. We're very much very concerned that we I hope that you will come out of this meeting feeling that it's worth your putting some of your time and some effort into campaigning around this issue. We want to take not just the anti-war voice, but the facts, the arguments, the perspectives, the people generated by the anti-war movement in this country into the editorial meetings in the British media up and down the country. Not because we expect the media to become anti-war, no, but we expect the media to cease being so pro-war and to take the arguments seriously, to take our arguments seriously. And that means being active, being involved, those people of you who are in the media yourselves or are interested and want to campaign around the media. One of the themes of tonight's meeting is going to be just how we can do that most effectively and how we can make our voices heard. And really, it should therefore be appropriate that we start the meeting with a speaker who will be familiar to many of you who have been on the massive anti-war demonstrations, whether it's Hyde Park, Trafalgar Square, or outside of Parliament. She's the convener of the Stop the War Coalition, Lindsay German.
Well, thank you very much, and I'd like, first of all, to bring greetings from the Stop the War Coalition to this meeting, because I think that the question of the media and the war and the related questions is one of the most important things that we can discuss, and it's a question that we feel we fought on one front for the last 5 years now, since the war in Afghanistan, then the war in Iraq, the whole build-up to the war in Iraq, and then the catastrophe of the occupation that we've really seen since then, that we fought on that front. But of course there's another front as well, and the other front is how we can operate as people who work inside the media, as people who have some connection with the media, to try to establish some truth, some objectivity, some alternative view from the one that is very, very often given. And it's very easy, I suppose, for those of us who have campaigned against these wars to really see the media coverage as lies. You know, it's very, people say very commonly, the Prime Minister lied, the papers lie, Rupert Murdoch lies, all this kind of thing. And I've no doubt there's an element of that in it. And we can discuss, you know, the... Can you not hear me? Okay. All right, sorry. Can you hear me now? If I lean, okay. Sorry, but you only have to look at what is happening with the media to see it isn't just simply lies. We did have the Evening Standard's claim that Saddam and his weapons of mass destruction could hit us in 45 minutes. We did have those sorts of claims. But in a way, what's much more disturbing about the coverage of the war is the ignoring of the things that are going on, the refusal to cover, the failure to cover, sometimes the inability to cover, as is the case in many parts of Iraq and Afghanistan today. And people have read the wonderful book or seen the film All Quiet on the Western Front by a man called Eric Maria Remarque, who wrote this after the First World War. And he got the inspiration for the title from a headline in one of the German papers, which said, "Invest in nicht Neues." In other words, nothing to bother reporting. even though, this was by 1917, even though soldiers were dying every single day on the Western Front, but it wasn't worth anybody reporting these facts. And it seems to me, when you look today at the small piece of news, I don't know if people saw it, that the consulate in Basra, the British consulate, is removing some of its staff to Basra Airport because the old Basra Palace, where the consulate is situated, is simply too dangerous for those staff to work in it. Now, this is something that, unless you followed this very closely, unless you're an Iraqi, unless you're an expert, unless you look at all these kinds of questions, or maybe unless you're a diplomat in the British Foreign Service, you wouldn't know that this was the case. You wouldn't know how dangerous it was. You wouldn't know that any of these things are happening. And we can report this. The fact that the Americans last week said that they've lost control of Baghdad and they tried to regain control, but they didn't succeed in doing it. All of these things are things which really tell you that we're not getting the kind of reporting that we want to get. Sometimes the military restrict people from doing it. Certainly often the news organisations don't regard it as a priority. And it is a very, very serious problem for us in terms of the way in which the thing works. But of course there's another side to it as well, which I'm sure other people will talk about tonight. I just want to refer to it briefly. Which is that we have a war at home as well. We have a war at home, a government which wages war on Iraq and Afghanistan, also wages war on the people who have opposed the war here, and in particular the attacks on civil liberties that we've seen, and the onslaught on Muslims in the media, coming from, essentially coming from, government ministers over the last few weeks and months, is part of that war at home. You know, when I read about the one example, the Forest Gate brothers, the two brothers who were whose house was raided, tiny little terraced house in Newham, who had 200 police who came to raid their house. One of them was shot in the process of the raid. The whole of the house was taken apart. The neighbours had to move out. The family had to move out for weeks and weeks and weeks. They're only just now back in their house. And when you look at what was said about that, you had these huge headlines the day after they were arrested, that they had chemical vests, that they were planning a chemical bomb, whatever a chemical vest is, but they were told, by all the newspapers, this is what they had, that they were dangerous people. A week later, after they'd been in custody for a week, they were released without charge. This hardly made the headlines of the following week's papers. It hardly made the front pages, I think, of any of the newspapers. And that building up of this climate of fear, a climate where the war on terror is something that is dealt with not by looking at the real facts, but by looking at the way in which the domestic population is attacked, is something that we're seeing more and more. And it seems to me that those questions are very, very important questions for us, and particularly for people who work in the media, who have any access to the media, who have any influence over the media. It seems to me these are questions that we have to deal with, because we are now reaching a point where they've lost the arguments over the war itself. Nobody now believes, apart from George Bush, Tony Blair, and no doubt a few ever self-selecting a smaller group of people who advise them, nobody now believes that the war on Iraq was a good idea. Fewer and fewer people are believing that we can really win what I think is an unwinnable war in Afghanistan. And that means that they are turning on the domestic agenda much more. Now, tomorrow, and again you won't have read this in your newspapers very much, there's a debate in Parliament on the question of the Iraq war. Now, don't get too excited, because you perhaps should get excited, because this is 3.5 years since we've had a debate on this terrible situation, and that in itself is an incredible fact. But of course it's not called by the government party, it's not called by the main opposition party, it's called by two small parties, the Scottish Nationalists and the Welsh Nationalists, the parties which are given a day every few months to have these debates. Tomorrow they're having a debate and we're going to have a demonstration outside. But this is something which tells you, in a way, the complicity of certainly the national media and the people at the top of the media, that we haven't had this debate and nobody bothers to question it. I guess it won't get very well reported tomorrow. Maybe I'm wrong, but I guess the Labour MPs will stay away, and lots of the Tory MPs will stay away, and then everybody will say it wasn't really much of a debate. And yet this is a question where 62% of people in the poll last week believe that the troops should be immediately withdrawn from Iraq. And that tells you the gap between what the government wants us to think and what their friends who own the media and the top editors of the media want us to think, the gap between them and what the people on the ground, the people who've campaigned against the war, the people who can see the destruction that the war is doing, who can see that we could spend, there are many, many things that we could easily spend our money on and spend it on much, much better. So that is the situation we now have. I think we have grounds for hope, however. I think, firstly, there are many, many very fine journalists who do try to challenge the accepted view, both the people who have columns and who have access to columns, although most journalists don't have that kind of position, but also what the people at the Daily Star did when they said they weren't going to print the Islamophobic front page, and where they said, we are not going to have this paper used in this kind of way to... And let's face it, the Daily Star has plenty of racist stereotypes at certain times in its coverage. But to stand up against that, I think, was a very courageous and a very brave thing to do. And I hope that we can all take heart from what those people have done. But these discussions and these arguments and this attempt to not forget what is happening, to remember, for memory, to triumph over forgetting, is something that goes on and can go on every day in offices and newsrooms around the country. And that is one of the points of having the meeting tonight, and that is why I welcome the meeting so much tonight. And just the other point that can give us heart is this, that despite what the media says, despite what the government says, most people don't believe them on this particular question. That despite their constant attempts, despite the fact that you would think if you only watched Newsnight or you only listened to the Today programme, you would think that really the vast majority of people had only had a few sort of quibbles about the war, and it's only when the head of the British Army says that the British Army are doing more harm there than good that suddenly being against the war is a respectable mainstream kind of thing to do. That's the way that they project these things. When you look at what we have now done, despite the Today programme, which wouldn't even take anybody from Stop the War on the day that we had 2 million people marching on the streets of London because they said it wasn't relevant to their thing, their agenda. The fact that we know that the BBC didn't always make sure they could get pro-war voices in all these times, and the fact that the Hutton report, I think, has seriously caused problems in terms of the BBC even reporting in the way that they did during the time of the war. So there are all those questions, which are very serious questions for us, but also let's take heart from the fact that despite the government's best intentions, despite the spin doctors and despite their allies inside the press, the best of the journalists and the best of the people who read the papers or listen to the radio or watch the television don't believe what they're saying, can see beyond the stories that they do, although they don't put out, to the truth that is going on. And that is a great encouragement to us. So I would just like to conclude by saying that we'd like to, for people to come and join us tomorrow outside Parliament if you can. On the 18th of November, we have a conference, what we call the People's Assembly, again, which is entitled Islamophobia and the War on Terror, where we're going to discuss the links between what they're doing to Muslims in this country and what that has to do with the wars that they're waging abroad. And we hope that you'll do everything you can to support those. On the 11th of November as well, we have an Armistice Day for Afghanistan and Iraq, which we'll have the military families outside the cenotaph the day before all the politicians go there. So we hope that you will join us on any of those activities or any of the other activities that we have. But most importantly, we hope that this meeting will inspire you to campaign to make sure that the truth gets out there and to make sure that whatever the people that you work for, whatever the people who run the newspapers would like to happen, that we can begin to set a very different agenda.
Thank you, Lindsay. And I believe Lindsay's got another meeting to go to after this. So
thanks again for finding the time to come to speak to us. I think many of us will have had the experience of seeing an article or a report that we believe is biased, quite often the response of the media is to say, well, we published another article at another time or another report which showed the other side. And this is why academic research into the overall picture that the media paints is so important. And so I'm very pleased to welcome our next speaker, who's Professor Justin Lewis from the Cardiff University School of Journalism, whose team has done a tremendous amount of research into the media coverage, British media coverage, of the invasion of Iraq, which appeared in this book, Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Professor Lewis.
Thank you. I want to make two points, really, this evening. The first is a point that comes out of the research we did for the book. The research was begun on the basis of a commission that came from the BBC. After the Iraq War, Greg Dyke suggested that some independent research was needed to look at the whole issue of embedding, as a number of people had begun to have a few doubts and qualms about the embedding process. So we were asked to do some research into that. And the research we did covered a lot of bases. We looked at coverage, we spoke to journalists, we spoke to the Pentagon, we spoke to the MOD, we did surveys and so forth. And I won't even begin to try and summarise some of the things we looked at, really just to make one point that comes out of the book. And that is to do with the nature of the coverage and why it changes and why its political character changes. I suppose you could say that the coverage of the Iraq War went through three quite different phases. The phase before the war began was at least relatively open. A number of different stories were told. The debate was reasonably wide-ranging. The same can be said for the period after the war was over, at least after the war had been over for a few weeks, a couple of months. But during the war itself, and the period immediately before and after, when we looked at the coverage, we found that during that period, coverage really closes down. Coverage became it was much less about a whole range of stories and much more about really one story. And the only story that was really told during the war itself was the story actually of the war. How was the war going? Who was winning? Who was losing? How were the battles being fought? Was the war being won? And so forth. And the reason for that is partly because news media tend to focus on the sort of newsworthy aspects of battle. That's clearly one reason. But another reason for that was because of the widespread embedding program that the Pentagon in particular, but also the Ministry of Defence, vigorously pursued. And I think that the thinking behind that program is something that should give us all pause and make us think about the nature of covering war and conflict. It was clear from our discussions with the Pentagon that they were no longer thinking about the media coverage of war in terms of the old model of censorship. You know, they were no longer thinking that the way we get good coverage is to clamp down on journalists and stop them talking about things. They, if you like, had moved way beyond that. They were now thinking very much in terms of public relations. And public relations teaches you very early on that, you know, the way you get good coverage is not just by stopping people speaking, it's by promoting discussions and stories that you want told. And the story that the Pentagon wanted told was a story of a war being won successfully and quickly by US-led forces. And that was the story that was told up until the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein, that famous iconic moment. And in that sense, it was extraordinarily successful. Public opinion, which was against the war beforehand and against the war afterwards, during the crucial stages of the war itself, was in favour of the war. So it was a kind of a moment of validation during a key period. And I think, one of the things that we were struck by when we spoke to journalists about the coverage of war was the sense that the main problem in dealing with the military is a problem of censorship. The military essentially seen as knowing quite a lot, far more than in fact they do. We found intelligence within the military to be very clunky, and often, you know, various people within the military knew far less than journalists did at any given point. But the assumption is that the military know a lot, and they're just not telling us. So the question is one of access and one of information. And so when the embeds were given a great deal of information, which they were, the assumption was that was no longer a problem. And so I suppose the point that we would make in the book is that what journalists need to do is move beyond that model. That it's no longer about censorship. It's no longer about not being told what's going on. It's as much now about questioning when you are given information as questioning when you're not. In other words, if you are suddenly given access to a lot of information, you have to begin to ask, well, why is this? Why is this happening? And one of the things that we found was that the story of the war itself obliterated all other questions and stories during the weeks of the sort of main stage of the war. Questions about the aftermath, questions about the efficacy of the war, all those questions disappeared completely. The second point I want to make is about the media coverage of terrorism. Whenever we look at the way in which issues are covered in media, one of the things that becomes abundantly clear early on is that there's often not much relationship between the volume of media coverage of an issue and what's going on in the real world. Crime is a great example. If you want to know how much crime there is at any given moment, then reading the papers is not going to tell you. Now, the reason for that, I mean, that shouldn't surprise us. I mean, news doesn't focus on the typical. So why should it be a good arbiter of various trends? And one of the things that we were interested in looking at was that true of terrorism? So we did something very simple, really, which is to compare the volume of terrorism over the last 20 years with the media coverage of terrorism over the last 20 years. Now, the first of those things is very difficult to measure. So we took as our measurement the US Department of State's own data on this. And the US Department of State, up until 2005, published data for the last 20 years on the number of international terrorist incidents around the globe. Actually, it's amazing how few people actually went and looked at this. It was on their website. Very few people actually looked at it. And one of the things that's very surprising about that data is that it almost completely contradicted the kind of messages that were coming out of the White House and elsewhere. What that data showed very powerfully is that the volume of international terrorism around the world from about the mid-80s onwards has steadily declined. In other words, there are fewer terrorist incidents. So, for example, the years of the last 20 years with the fewest international terrorist incidents were 2002 and 2003, years in which there was a huge volume of media coverage of that issue. Whichever period you look at, you find mismatches. 1986, there was a huge upsurge in media coverage of international terrorist incidents, and yet there were fewer incidents that year than there were in 85 and 87. So there's not really a great deal of relationship between the two. And what we see in the coverage of terrorism is, on the whole, a gradual decline of terrorist incidents, also the volume of incidents. Actually, over the last few years, the year which had the highest number of terrorist casualties, according to the State Department, was 1998, not 2001. There were more people killed in 1998 than 2001. And yet the assumption is that the peak year was 2001 and things have been at a high level ever since. That's what you find from media coverage. That's the way media coverage looks. You get a huge upsurge in 2001 and it maintains itself at a high level it has ever since. But in fact, there is a substantial mismatch between that and the only data that we have available. So I suppose one of the things we begin to need to do is to think seriously about looking at the data that lies behind those headlines and thinking about whether the huge upsurge in the reporting of terrorism actually relates to something going on in the real world or not. And I would suggest the data suggests that, in fact, surprisingly, it doesn't.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. And Justin mentioned the issue of embedded journalists. You might be aware that the Ministry of Defence has banned ITV News from embedding its journalists with British troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is a time when, as you know, discontent in the army about what they're doing in the war on terror is at a height. And in this regard, Media Workers Against the War has issued a statement today, which you might find actually underneath you on your seats at the moment, calling for the ban to be lifted and for free access for journalists to British troops abroad. And I'd encourage you to take copies, which you'll find out on the table at the back of the room afterwards, and to gather signatures of work if you can. Our next speaker is a very experienced BBC Middle East correspondent. He was a correspondent there, I think, for over 15 years, from the mid-1970s, and writes and speaks widely on the Middle East and the media, and is now a freelance journalist, and also on the executive board of the Council for Arab-British Understanding. Please welcome Tim Llewellyn.
I want to start by telling just a very brief story about myself, not because I'm indulging in ego journalism, which is very popular these days, but it does illustrate a much wider point about the BBC. And I harp on the BBC because I think it's pretty obvious to all of us who work in the media that the BBC is probably the most important single institution in Britain as regards transmitting and gathering news of international matter. And most people in this country do get their information, for better or for worse, from BBC News, and mostly from BBC television. In fact, you could say about the BBC that the more intelligent the coverage, the more minority the programme. In other words, in my experience, BBC television news is probably the most, is probably the worst offender in terms of truly balanced coverage of the Middle East, whereas if you tune into the World Service, say in the middle of the night, or perhaps to some aspect of Radio 4 late at night, you might find something approaching a decent and balanced coverage. But my point is that most people watch television news, either at 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and some, of course, the Today programme, which we've already mentioned, which I think is very lax, is also terribly important. So it's to these programs I'm really addressing my views. Now, over the past, the story about myself is very briefly this. I covered the Middle East for the BBC for on and off 15 years as a staff correspondent, 10 years as a Middle East correspondent, and then another 8 or 9 years as a freelance contributor. Around 2000, I suddenly discovered that a memo had been put out by BBC management about me, not to my knowledge, but I found out, of course, it's one of those dozens of journalists, that a memo had been put around saying that if Tim Llewellyn ever appears on the BBC to talk about the Middle East, it is to be made clear that he was never, said or mentioned that he was in fact a BBC correspondent. In other words, the organisation I'd worked for 21 years was disowning me. Now, I am not a member of the British National Party, racist, anti-Semite, I do not have a dog in the fight in the Middle East. My campaign, like the institutions which I work with, the Council for Arab British Understanding, Arab Media Watch, and I work on my own behalf, has been purely and simply to try and get the standards of Middle East coverage, the fairness and justice of Middle East coverage, improved, especially by the BBC. What we found, and this is enough, it seems, to have excited the Israeli and pro-Israeli lobby to the extent that they have actually campaigned against people like me in the BBC on the grounds that we are somehow beyond the pale. And it's been effective. This is the point, not so much the point of what happened to me. It doesn't bother me that much. But the point is that the BBC is a very frightening organisation and has been extremely frightened. It's always been frightened, but it's been very, very frightened since the year 2000. When the new uprising, the Intifada, the armed uprising began, and the situation in Palestine and Israel became extremely fraught and extremely dangerous and extremely violent, and the Israelis wildly overreacted by sending their army into the occupied territories and carrying out the most appalling atrocities there, and equally the Palestinians replied by using dreadful suicide bombs. A debate we don't want to get into here, but it's from that date. The Israelis decided, and their friends, of whom they have many and who are very proud, decided that they would never make the mistake again that they made in 1982 and lose the publicity battle. They exerted extraordinary pressures on the BBC, and the BBC has been a nervous organisation ever since. What we found, in many reports, for instance, Greg Filer's very well-known, very analytical report which was made 2 or 3 years ago at the University of Glasgow, other reports from other institutions, as findings from Cardiff and other Strathclyde University, I think there's many other organisations and think tanks, have found basically that the BBC's coverage is not pro-Israeli in the sense that there's some vast Zionist conspiracy going on and lots of Jews sitting in the room somewhere in the BBC orchestrating coverage. That's not true. It never has been true. Conspiracies in the BBC do not work and never could work. I worked there long enough to know that. However, there is definitely an imbalance of the reporting, partly caused, I think, by extreme pressure. The BBC management does not like being shouted at and screamed at and accused of being anti-Semitic. Nobody does. But when you have nervous suits running big organizations, big corporations, like the British Broadcasting Corporation, then these tactics seem to work. But more than that, there is still, I think, inside the BBC, and probably in most British cultural institutions, which should by now be knowing better, given the makeup of their staffs, the makeup of their readerships, listenerships, and viewerships, there is still, I think, a cultural lag here somehow going on, in that people still regard the Arabs, or the Arabs in particular, but Muslims in general, as the other, as something alien, as something foreign. Palestinians aren't people like us, Israelis are people like us. Israelis go to supermarkets, drive full escorts, and go on holidays to the beach on package holidays, and they sing in the Eurovision Song Contest, and they play football in Liverpool. This kind of thing, this matters, this makes people feel familiar and at ease, and therefore the image of trouble, of suicide bombings, which are dreadful incidents, but the imagery of people like us being damaged, the state, with official paraphernalia, with ministers, proper police forces, proper army. This carries a resonance with people in this country, which, seeing similar actions taking place on the Palestinian side, do not happen. And one of the main problems I think the BBC has had, and it was identified in a report which came out earlier this year by an impartial panel, which was appointed by the Board of Governors, and much of which I agreed with, and we all agreed with, was that the BBC was not reporting adequately on the conditions of the Palestinians and the suffering the Palestinians were undergoing in the occupied territories. To put it very simply, if you do not report day by day from those areas about how those people are treated under occupation, there are many other issues, but this is a basic one. If you do not report from there on these conditions, then you are not explaining the context or the background for why these people behave the way they do, why suicide bombs, why armed opposition goes on towards Israel, why the Palestinians are so aggrieved, why indeed the Palestinians are fighting amongst themselves. If you do not explain that, and the BBC has not explained it adequately, then you are leaving half the story out. There is a spurious equivalence of work, as I call it in many articles, a spurious equivalence in that there are two sides in this dispute. The Israelis on one side and the Palestinians on the other. And somehow they are equal, and they both got right on their side, and they both got wrong on their side. And this ignores the report by this independent panel agreed with this. It ignored the fact of the Palestinian conditions, it ignored the conditions of the Palestinians, but also it's an example of how this kind of cultural misunderstanding operates. We're not telling them the full story. And there is no equivalence, in effect, between the occupied and the occupier. And that's a terribly important point, which I don't think the BBC's reporting has yet addressed completely. Now, we haven't got much time, and many other areas I could go into. We found, it was also found, much of which we suspected and found out with our own analysis, Greg Filer's famous analysis found it, but the Board of Governors agreed with it, with more findings by more think tanks and their own observations, going on the evidence from people like me and the Council for Outreach Understanding and Media Watch, that the Israelis have given far more time to explain their case on the BBC than the other side. In terms of actual officials, on the mainstream bulletins of the BBC, the Israelis and the Palestinians were fairly level picking. But when it came to generalized comment, when it came to people other than official spokesmen, the Israelis won the day in at least four or five separate categories. They fire out Muslims, that number of the Palestinians, in terms of putting their case across. Another major lacuna, in my view, is the fact that both in the recent Lebanon War, during the Iraq War, and of course during the continuing Palestinian crisis, which has been going on for many, many years now, the BBC should know better, We do not hear adequately the Arab voice. We do not hear the Iraqi voice, the Palestinian voice, the Arab view of these conflicts, which are taking place in Arab territory. There are many other points that perhaps will come up in your questions, but very broadly, I think the encouraging news is that broadly, the board of governors, this impartiality review, did shake up the BBC. And it's very valuable for the BBC to have this report, to fight back against the lobbyists who threaten it, menace it, and generally frighten it. And there are signs the BBC is beginning to take some notice. I'm not terribly happy. I was going to talk to you about a little bit about the film that was put out about Iran and Israel the other night, which is a totally biased, absolutely disgraceful film, which we aren't complaining about officially. If you want to ask me about that in the rest of the extra time, as it were, I'll talk about that. But the BBC has promised that it will appoint a permanent correspondent in the occupied territories for the first time. We hope to hear from those bigger voices, as is the voice we hear from Israel itself, or from what part of it, from West Jerusalem, which is de facto Israel. And there are signs that the BBC is beginning to mend its way. So I'm not totally depressed, but I will say this: it does show that pressure works. What I'm asking you all to do here is to realise that what we try to do is not what the friends of Israel and Israeli lobbies do. Not scream and shout and hurt and curse and threaten and cajole. What we want to have and what's worked for us is intelligent, thoughtful, analytical criticism and praise where praise is due. We're always very careful to send emails and messages to the BBC when they do something good. And they do. Last week's report from Afghanistan by Freya Joyner was an extremely good report. It's upset the Tory party and the Labour party with that. Good. That's what we want. It's upset all these bloody people. But give praise where it's due, but be on to them. And I can tell you for one hour, there's names, emails, numbers, people to call. Keep the pressure up. It's a slow process, but it does have an effect in the end. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tim. And I should have said at the beginning that if we have time, we will fit in some questions and contributions to the speakers from the floor. Our next speaker probably won't need much of an introduction to you, because you'll know her through her columns in the national press. In an extremely powerful column in last week's Independent, about a week ago, she compared Bush and Blair's war in Iraq to the final scene in Shakespeare's Henry VI Part 3, where Edward IV is soaked in blood on the battlefield, but doesn't realise that he's soaked in blood. And in the same way, Blair and Bush are so besotted with themselves that they can't see the bloodstains on themselves, that what they've done to the people of Iraq is at least as bad as what Saddam Hussein did to his own citizens, and that they should both be in the dock in The Hague answering for these crimes. She is Yasmin Alibayran.
For turning up late. And I only speak as a flawed practitioner, because one of the important things about what we've just heard, is it not on? Yes. Thank you. Is that all right? Is one of the most important things, it seems to me, to keep an eye our understandings of various conflict situations is ongoing, sober research, not the mad rants of columnists like myself, which are of the moment. But here are some observations anyway. I think one of the things that I have only begun to understand properly, because I'm still an outsider really, is how the patriotic spirit comes alive when a war is declared. And it's almost an instinct in most British people, indigenous British people. And when that patriotic spirit arises, the first time I kind of witnessed it but didn't quite understand it was, of course, during the Falklands era. But this time, there was this build-up, very conflictual build-up, to the war. Everybody knew that we were divided, angry. Many of us, I would say most of us, knew it was a completely, well, it was, in my view, a criminal adventure. And yet, when it started, almost like a starting pistol, we had to go into patriotism. And actually, it's very difficult to go into patriotism if you have very strongly held views about an unjust war. And I think that is part of the reason, besides the kind of very clever PR stuff and what you described so well, that there is a kind of mood that takes over. And it's almost, I should never forget, being foolishly on a Question Time program. I was right fit up by the BBC then. I mean, if ever there was a fit up, and they denied it, but afterwards Greg Dyke more or less confessed it in his book. But it was this fit up because every Question Time was turning out to be anti-war. And of course, the government was getting more and more. Campbell was getting hysterical. And so they almost had to design a Question Time, actually create a Question Time, breaking all the rules of the program itself, to make a pro-war Question Time, which they did. And they did it in the most extraordinary way. But what I hadn't, and I said what I believed, which you do, they put this woman next to me. I'd done a lot of Question Times. I'd never had this experience of one person sitting uncomfortably close just to me. They put me at the end there. And before I could my third sentence, she was at me saying, "I was raped. I was done this to. I was done this to. You're a supporter of Saddam Hussein. Here, do you want to see? Do you want?" And, you know, what do you do? What do you say? And every time I opened my mouth, this woman would go for me. So finally I said, "Excuse me, you know what? Please don't emotionally blackmail me. I have a view." Well, that was it, wasn't it? Because the kind of patriotic fever, plus this very interesting setup Question Time, my goodness, you know, if they could have killed me and hung me out to dry up there, they would have. The letters were all about, when we are in the situation going into war, you people can never be patriotic, you people meaning, I suppose, of slightly darker skins. That's something I think I've really learnt about. But the other thing, and I want to, maybe this is going against the trend of the general thrust of what has been said so far. I'm actually incredibly proud of the media over this war. I really am, with all the reservations that I have about it. Because we didn't let it die when the government wanted it to die. We never let it go off the pages. We never let them go even 2 days without somebody standing up to remind them that the war's still going on. The war wasn't over when the statue fell. The war isn't over. The war carries on. And I think with such a powerful, hawkish pro-war lobby in the media, including, of course, ex-lefty friends, who shall have to remain nameless, but we know who they are, who even now haven't said, some of them have begun to say, mea culpa, we should have not fallen for this, but others have got even more gung-ho about it. With all of that going on, we, in the media, in spite of all the obstacles, kept this thing going. And I think, with all the kind of arrogance of New Labour, that they could push this through on spin like no other government had, we beat them. And I think we should feel proud sometimes of working in this media. We beat them. We did not let them win that particular battle. And I feel incredibly proud of that, because the cost personally for me and many others has been immense. Immense in terms of lots of stuff. I don't want to go into that. And just as examples of how at key moments when the thrust was upon us to go in a certain direction, a number of us rebelled. When the Black Watch story, do you remember? Fallujah happened, and the story in our papers was Black Watch. They did not want to talk about Fallujah. They only wanted to talk about our boys. And I feel very sorry for our soldiers. Most of them didn't want this war and don't want it at all anymore. But the story, surely, in terms of our conscience or even a media narrative could not possibly or should not have been Blackwatch. When they come home, when Fallujah was being completely demolished. And we still haven't told the story of Fallujah. We still have not told the proper story of Fallujah. Now, I remember writing this, saying, actually, I'm not interested in Blackwatch. Long may they live. I don't want to get romantic about Blackwatch. I want to know what Blackwatch actually did in Fallujah. That's the story I want to know. And I thought, oh, all right, you know, bunker down. Here it comes, because it always does, you know, the kind of... But it didn't. It didn't. What you got instead were people who were equally appalled. That when there was such an obvious case of collective punishment of a people, how could we be talking about our boys? So that was quite an interesting turning point. And I can only read these things through the... I get about 600 to 800 emails every week, and you can judge things, but only in a very kind of ad hoc way, not as proper research.